You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, today on the show, we have Jim Mercurio. Now, Jim is a filmmaker, a writer, and an author, and is a screenwriting consultant. And Creative Screenwriting ranked him as one of the country's top story analysts. He's worked with Oscar-nominated and A-list writers, as well as complete beginners. And I was introduced to Jim by a course that I actually have on IFH TV called A-List Screenwriting. And when I saw his workshops, I was extremely impressed with his take on story and his approach to helping writers with their screenwriting process. So I called Jim up and I said, Jim, I got to have you on the show. And he was so kind and giving of his time to come in and share his knowledge and experience with you guys, the tribe. So without any further ado, enjoy my conversation with Jim Mercurio. I'd like to welcome to the show Jim Mercurio, man. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, Alex, you know, thanks for having me. I think we'll have some fun today.
Absolutely, man. I'm here to pick your brain about screenwriting and how to write a better script.
Sounds good.
So first of all, how did you get into the film business in the first place?
Oh, you know, I always wonder if I'm really like in the film business. You know, I spent a decade making these low budget films from like 2000 to 2010 and they didn't make a bunch of money. But, you know, it's like the passion's there, the experience is there. So I've kind of been like, I'm outside of the Hollywood system. And, you know, in the last decade, things have changed a lot. So I'm back to where, like, a lot of writers are, you know, writing spec scripts and, you know, taking little assignments here and there. Mm-hmm. So I just don't, you know, I love filmmaking. I don't want to sound like cliche. I wanted to be a director. I mm-hmm. thought screenwriting was definitely a way through. and I got a master's in film, but there wasn't a huge emphasis on screenwriting. So when I first moved to L.A. in the 90s, I wanted to figure out screenwriting kind of inside and out. Like I had to kind of teach it to myself. So, you know, kind of over the years of like being the student and then, you know, segueing into like development and, you know, producing and then teaching and stuff. I don't know. It's always been just about wanting to eventually direct and just be able to tell stories on this big grand scale. But like even as a kid though, like, you know, like my friends were watching Star Wars and I was watching like 70s Scorsese and movies and conspiracy films. I always came to film like as an adult, like thinking you could do really smart stuff and, you know, theme and like, you know, really gritty character stuff. So I don't know. I've always loved movies. I've loved storytelling and cinema just seemed like maybe the Hollywood that I imagined existed when I, you know, first came out to Hollywood mm-hmm. never really was there or something like I missed by a couple of decades. But I just, you know, always wanted to tell you know, be part of telling these great stories, these great character studies and like great, exciting stories, you know, on this big grand scale.
Now, how did you get involved in teaching screenwriting and your theories behind it?
Well, like I said, part of my, you know, quest was I have to figure out the screenwriting thing for myself. Mm-hmm. So the first few years in Los Angeles, I was like working another job and I was just like, you know, reading every book, writing. And then I started writing for Creative Screenwriting. And I said to him, to Eric, my buddy, who eventually produced a couple movies with me, I said, let me go take all these story guru classes. I was trying to, like, you know, be smart and resourceful, save myself a few $1,000s, and I'll write a review about it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, 20-some years ago, you know, I went to I think I'd taken McKee, but I
had to. Everyone takes McKee.
I think I did them before that, but then as part of this process, I did Truby and Walter and Kitchen and Haig and just a bunch of people. So it was like, and then eventually, it was interesting, I ended up directing like 40 DVDs with a lot of those people. So it's like I was immersing myself as the student, but it's like to know something so well, you kind of have to, like, if you can teach something, you know it better than if you can't, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So like I was learning this stuff and I was integrating it and I wasn't thinking about teaching it. I was just like trying to learn it for myself. But then these chances came up to like, do notes for a friend, you know, write a script review. You like my notes. Someone else wanted to do notes. So as I started kind of figuring it out for myself, I would call on what I learned from other people. But I started kind of like figuring out, oh, wait a second. See, these are kind of the rules and principles that I'm using for myself. And they seem to be working. They seem to like align or pull together 15 different theories or 3 or 4 different gurus into a way that makes sense for me. So it just started kind of naturally like, oh, I can explain it to myself so I can explain it to someone else fairly well.
So why do most people and screenwriters, why do most screenwriters fail at screenwriting?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The thing with like first-time scriptwriters, beginning scriptwriters, people always ask me, well, what's the most common thing that's wrong with the script? And I'm like, well, kind of everything. And I don't mean it as a slight. No, I don't mean it as a slight. I mean, like, they don't know what they're supposed to know. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't know the care and the time and the attention that it takes. So it's like a lot of times I think like with beginning screenwriters – or if I'm working with someone as a coach or, you know, consultant, it's like the first and best thing I can do is kind of like open their eyes and say, this is what great screenwriting is. These are the expectations you have to have. And if I'm allowed to go on a little tangent.
Sure.
You know, did you see the movie The Arrival?
Yes, I did.
Okay, cool little sci-fi movie. They used a hyperbolic version of this thing called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. It's this idea that language, your language that you have affects your worldview. So in that, it was very hyperbolic. In that movie, it was like, if you learn their circular language, you'll be able to, you know, visit the future and the past, and that'll be super powerful. And obviously, you know, real life, it doesn't quite work that way. The cliched example, and I don't even know if it's true or if this is scientific anymore, but like, let's say an Eskimo has 40 different types of snow they recognize. Mm-hmm. So when it snows, they see something different than, say, maybe what I'll see because they know it exists. So, like, there's a different view of the world. And the same thing with screenwriting. Like, if you know 30 different things and you just have names for them, like, you know, whatever, an ellipsis or exposition or reframe, just like little tricks that writers do or craft principles, mm-hmm. even if you don't know how to do them yet, but you're aware of them, you're already ahead of the game. Because you're going to be learning them faster, you're going to recognize them in other movies. You're going to expect that your films and your story should have them. So it's like if I say, "Hey, man, your opening image should always augur theme and be like right on the nose or on point with what the movie's about," and you've never even thought about that, but now that you think about it, you go back and watch your 10 favorite movies, and you're like, "Oh, hey, wow! Like I didn't realize it, but Citizen Kane has an opening image that does that exactly, and so does, you know, this movie, and so does Seven, which I know you're a Fincher fan, and these movies." It's all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait a second. Every great movie that I've loved, I just realized, has a really profound and concise opening image that like augurs theme and sets up the character. And every time the character's introduced, it's like the dilemma's right there. So it's like if you start seeing things that you didn't even know existed, you know, like you're already ahead of the game. You're going to learn faster. You're going to start having that expectation for your script. So it's like a lot of it is, I mean, not to, you know, say, hey, those of you who aren't in the club yet, it's hard and you don't know what's going on. It's like, hey, no, just respect this. Like there's a lot to learn. structure and character and theme. And then when you get all that stuff down, then there's like rewriting and subtlety and nuance. So it's like I just feel like it takes a while to do. And a lot of times it's not even that, hey, a beginning script is like, hey, there's a problem. It's like, no, you're exactly where you're supposed to be. Like there's talent, there's some intuition, there's some great moments, you know, and depending on your skill level or if you believe in innate talent, there might be different levels of where a script is, but it's not supposed to do everything like the first time or the second time. It's like, that's why, you know, I respect and like, you know, like it would be like, you know, it would be bad self-esteem for me to say like, oh, well, I spent all this time trying to help people learn all the nuances and you know, and finesses that can be done with screenwriting. If it's like, oh, yeah, it's kind of easy. And like, you know, it's really only 10 things you should know. And if you know that and read one book, that's enough. It's like, no, man, this is really hard. And like, you know, I'm still learning myself or, you know, or like in the last 5 years or my 20 years of figuring this out, there's still stuff I'm learning when I read like great screenplays.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, absolutely. And that's the thing. A lot of screenwriters and filmmakers for that matter think it's an easy process. And like, oh, if I just put the hero's journey on everything, or if I just, you know, use Truby's technique, or if I just use this technique or that technique, there's no one answer.
Yeah. But the thing is though, like, we'll talk, you want to talk about this later, but like, I have a kind of focus on screenwriting and I write about it somewhat, and it's like, you know, that specific approach is, it's not that, you know, Truby structure or Sid Field or Save the Cat. It's not that I have to say no to any of that, mm-hmm. but it's like an improv, it's yes and. But it's like, you know, one thing isn't going to answer it all. Like, you know, like Vogler stuff is really good, mm-hmm. especially for some sorts of stories. But like you can, I would say like a lot of Vogler stuff for a lot of stories is how do you phrase it? It's necessary but not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, yes, every story will have some kind of reluctance in the first act maybe, mm-hmm. and there'll be threshold guardians. There'll be some kind of forces or people or elements that try to stop the person or the protagonist from going to that new world. Mm-hmm. But if it's just an obstacle, if it's just an ogre in the road with a club, mm-hmm. that's not going to be enough. It has to be also on a psychological level. So it's true that yes, all these stories will have these obstacles, but if you have the obstacle, it's not enough. It also needs to resonate on psychological level. It also has to be aligned to that character. So it's like, I'm very often saying yes and like, yeah, read Save the Cat, read Richard Walter, read Michael Haig. If Truby works for you, especially the genre stuff, yeah, use it. And nothing I say should really ever contradict it. It mm-hmm. should just kind of enhance it or maybe reframe it in a way that works for someone better.
So what you're saying is that ogre with the club should be the long-lost father of the character.
Well, it might create it more interesting. It might not be so on the nose.
Of course.
Right. But it might be just the smallest hint of that, like, you know, I'm ready to leave town and I'm driving out of my hometown and a policeman pulls me over. Well, that's like an ogre with a club. But wait a second, what if it's like a guy from high school who kinda thinks I'm a big shot or kinda puts me down or thinks or kinda reminds me that, hey, you're not really supposed to leave this town. You're destined to be this small town person. You're not supposed to go to Los Angeles or mm-hmm. who are you to have these big dreams? And all of a sudden it's like, yeah, it's the negative father figure or it's mm-hmm, like, you know, mm-hmm. the uncle who's a foil character who failed at it, reminding you of the stakes. It's like it could be a very subtle way, but like I don't want you to get a ticket from a policeman because you were going too fast, and that's the point. I want that to represent something, and if it doesn't, then that policeman doesn't belong in the script. Like that incident, that scene doesn't belong there. You have to find the thing that does two things, both story and character. And you know, like when I talk about, you know, scenes, it's like you want your scene to change at the story level, but also the character level. Mm-hmm. And pretty much your goal has to be always doing both. Like really, there's almost no reason to only do one of them, or if you do it a few times, that's fine. But you know, you only have a certain amount of opportunities to get insight into character and to make these important changes in the story. So why would you pass them up? You're always looking for like the internal and the external to kind of like move forward and change at the same time. And that's a tricky thing to do as a beginning screenwriter. So it takes a while to learn that as a skill.
Now, what makes a character? Well, since we're on the topic of characters, what makes a character interesting to an audience, in your opinion?
You know, I don't know. Like that's interesting because I don't necessarily like to like have these rules of like, well, this is what makes them likable. This is I'm more like, here's how you make a good character. And the essence of a great character is very simple. It comes down to one simple dilemma. So like at a craft level, like if you could ask the god of screenwriting or the muse of screenwriting like one question that would pretty much define or help you write your entire script, it would be – and it can be phrased a couple of ways. But one of them is like, what is my character's dilemma? At his core, you know, what is it that he's afraid of? What is the hard choice he has to make? Because that will pretty much answer everything. So if you have that nailed down – really specifically, that's what makes a great and complex character. And I'm not going to be the one to judge like, well, is he likable enough or what kind of traits does he have to have? I'm not going to say that. I'm just going to be push you. I push writers and storytellers to be like, I want you to be good at this and I want you to be good at writing characters. So I want you to understand what makes a dramatic character work. Like it all boils down, you know, to one thing. And one time I was saying this to a class and they were like, you know, oh, well, I don't think Shakespeare, blah, blah. I'm like, okay. Shakespeare, what's the first thing that comes to mind? They were like, well, to be or not to be. I'm like, well, duh, right? I mean, you know, like one thing, you know, Godfather, Michael, you know, be in or out, or the family's going to fall apart and that's horrible. I have to be a criminal, which will eventually lead to me killing my brother. But, you know, to protect my family and the legacy of my family, it's all going to go away if I don't step up and do this. And obviously, you know, he has his own flaw, but, you know. Or even Napoleon Dynamite. Like, the most important thing to Napoleon Dynamite is to be cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then what does he risk? Right, but what does he risk at the end for Pedro? He does that dance in front of everybody. He's willing to be a dork. And it's like, that's actually huge. Like, if he's just like, hey, vote for Pedro because I have this logical argument, that's not good storytelling. Mm-hmm. But it also doesn't give me insight into the character. Oh, well, the character's smart, and when push comes to shove – he's able to use rhetoric to defend his friend who's running for president. No. A guy who's so afraid of being unliked and being a dork is willing to sacrifice, to make the choice of I will risk not being liked, being so uncool if because of friendship and support and my alliance with a friend. It's like, you know, the idea of dilemma is kind of there at its core, and it'll basically help you write, I don't know, 90% of your script. So it's not so much I want to tell people what a good character should be, but like I want to give them the power to bring to life the characters they're trying to aim for and to know kind of what their aim should be, like how well they should know a character. Because if you know a character really super specifically, it then allows you to, you know, create the supporting characters that are more specific. It allows you to write great dialogue. Everything stems from that really specific understanding.
Do you agree that a hero is only as good as their villain that they're facing?
Well, yeah, but it's kind of back to what I was saying. It's like chicken egg. The perfect antagonist is the one who tests the weakness of the character. So if you don't know what that is, it's so like, oh, hey, Alex, you're the protagonist. I'm the antagonist. I'm going to get in your way. I mean, does that mean like I put my arms up and like move to like just block you from taking a step forward? Yeah. You know, in a story, that's part of it. But like, but if I know your weakness – and if I can prey on that, then that makes me a better antagonist, and that challenges you more. So now there's more conflict. So you have more, you know, you have more to kind of fight. You know, at the beginning of L.A. Confidential, you know, Dudley Smith is a great antagonist. He's a little bit like Darth Vader in that he's like he's more in full and more whole than Luke is. And he says to Exley, who's, you know, by the book, Goody Two Shoes, he says, would you plant evidence? Would you rough up somebody to get a confession? Would you shoot somebody in the back? Mm-hmm. And ironically, that's foreshadowing what has to happen later. But he's also saying, I know you're too Goody Two Shoes. I'm reminding you as conflict, but I'm also for myself testing. I know you wouldn't do those things. So I know you're already beaten. Like you can never beat me because you're limited into what you can do. And once you know that that specifically, then you can write better scenes. Like for instance, there's a little moment, like a second, where I show it to my class, and the first time they watch it 3 or 4 times and they don't get it. It's Christmas party at the precinct, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes off to the side to talk to him, and he grabs 2 glasses of punch from, you know, someone, and he hands it Exley, and he won't drink it. He doesn't take a drink, and it's like, oh my God, he's so Goody Two Shoes. Even at the Christmas party, the holiday party, he won't take a sip of punch because it has alcohol, and that's breaking the rules. And it's like, do you see how that's why that script wins an Oscar because that moment and that specificity of character is able to be put on display. So you might in your head think your character is so well defined that you know him or her, but until you can use craft to reveal that, you know, it's back to intention. You're not doing great screenwriting until you find ways to express that.
So I mean, I always use the example of the Joker in Nolan's Batman, which is as perfect of an antagonist as you can create. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way he wants to kind of break the value system of Batman, mm-hmm. he wants to show people are corrupt, and he wants to,
he has his own method. He has his own methodology in his own mind. Yes, his own core beliefs that are counter, and he wants to literally break Batman psychologically, yes. As opposed to like the 1960s Batman, where the Joker was just a kind of buffoon in his way. There was no depth there. If you're going to compare like the same characters written differently.
I would say that's totally apples and oranges. But
yeah, I know. It's not really fair.
You may even have done some of this because like, I know I've seen like a lot of people go into depth about that relationship and their philosophy. And that's the thing. Like, you know, ideally you have I don't believe that you have to write that 100-page backstory for everybody. Mm-hmm. I actually kind of believe in precision. Like if you can nail your antagonist's dilemma in a sentence, like those values then become like a contrasting sentence for the, for the antagonist. You know, it's like almost exact values. Like, you know, if in a love story, you know, if this character is supposed to believe in the power of love to overcome stuff, well, then the antagonist is someone who obviously is negative, doesn't believe that, and is really kind of good at showing or convincing that person that love is can't overcome and maybe isn't real. You know what I'm saying? Like they're challenging the exact most important things to the protagonist. So it's like kind of chicken egg. Like, yes, your antagonist becomes stronger, your protagonist has to become stronger to fight him. So it's like you need to align them kind of perfectly, because you might have a great antagonist, but it's the wrong antagonist for the story. Or you might have a great protagonist, but it's the wrong protagonist for the story. So you have to make sure that what the antagonist is good at challenging and making difficult, or the weaknesses he or she can pick at, are specific to in a line with the protagonist. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I mean, and I want to ask you a question. This is now a personal question I have.
Sure.
Because there's a character that I found extremely difficult to write for, which was Superman.
Okay.
Superman is such a difficult character because he literally is a god. So
right.
It's so difficult to create an antagonist that could even do anything against him. So you got the Lex Luthor with the real estate scams of both,
well,
like two different movies.
Right. But a couple movies did it pretty well. The Superman, the movie, the 1978 version.
Excellent.
Right. Okay, so a couple things. It's set up with who's the father? Jor-El. He says, you must not reveal who you are, because then people will hurt the people you love.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, so now we're set up. Okay, Superman's not vulnerable, but people he loves could be vulnerable. So what does Lex Luthor do? He sends the two rockets in opposite directions, and Lois Lane is in one direction, and you know, New York's in the other.
Yes.
Kind of the same thing that the Joker did, in Batman with Harvey and
yes,
and
yes.
And that,
I yeah, never right? saw that, but yeah, I mean, I never saw that connection.
Yeah,
but you're right.
He creates the dilemma, and then it's also set up, and this is, you know, it's a little bit contrived, but you have to do the work. You know, you can't change the course of things. So Superman has to decide whether he'll go in circles and turn back time, which is a little bit out of the blue, but it's like, it's at least on point. He has a big, huge moral question. Will you tamper and play God, you know, as Superman, or will you not do it? And he makes a mistake, but not a mistake. I mean, he chooses it, which makes him imperfect and human in a way, which, you know, we kind of like. Mm-hmm. And then in the Man of Steel, some flawed stuff, but a couple things. Like, it's really interesting that, when Kevin Costner, the dad character, says you can't let people know about you, and it was for slightly different reasons, because they won't understand.
His fear.
But an interesting thing was, he goes, so dad, should I let those kids on the bus? Should I let them have died? And he kind of said, and I forget if he says it or if he just kind of implies it, but it's kind of like, yeah, maybe. It's like, whoa. Like, oh, that's pretty intense. So in that final scene where, you know, he breaks the neck of Zod, mm-hmm. The dilemma is right there. Zod is fighting to hurt humans. He's like, his vision is like inches away. So he's fighting to pull his neck back. So it's like the only way he can stop him from killing those humans is to kill him. So Superman makes a choice that he never really makes, or is very kind of bold and like,
yeah, exactly.
But at least it's set up. So it's like you can't say, oh, he killed him because it was all he really could do or he was mad. No, he killed him because it was either kill him or humans would die. So once again, it's like they have to make vulnerable people be important to him. And then the vulnerability to the bad guy comes through the humans that are vulnerable. And it's, I'd say it's an effective strategy because otherwise, you know, what else are you going to do?
That's what I loved about Superman 2, the Donner cut, not the original, but the Richard Donner cut, which he had literally three Supermen versus right. him, and he lost his powers. And he had to do all the things that he did. And there was just a lot of complexity there, which arguably I think one of the better Superman. Those two are probably the best still to this day.
I'll tell you what, though. I mean, like story-wise and plot-wise, yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff going on there. But I have a question, though. Like if I say, like, man, you come out of Superman, the movie, the first one, mm-hmm. what'd you kind of learn? And I say, yeah, you know, like, man, you shouldn't play God, you shouldn't turn back time, and you're really vulnerable to humans and stuff. But like, if I say, what do you like, what's the theme or what's the character arc or what's the thing he learned in Superman 2? Mm-hmm. Like, now I haven't studied it. We might go back and it might be there and it might be subtle. But like, do you have an answer? Like, cause I feel like, it doesn't resonate as much for me. And this is back to my, like, kind of telling you, like, I came to movies as an adult, you know, like, so it's like, I don't want to be simplistic and say, well, movies should only be deep, dark, thematic character studies. Mm-hmm. But also, I don't believe movies should only be obstacle course roller coasters. Now, when I say that, people always say, what about Raiders of the Lost Ark? And I'm like, okay, I'll tell you what, if one time in the history of cinema, like the most talented, kinetic filmmaker ever was able to make a movie that was mostly a roller coaster, that was amazing, you know what, Steven Spielberg, but that can't be your goal. And it's like a dilemma. So a lot of times writers think they have a choice. I need to make it the roller coaster. I need a plot. I need to have this cool twist, or I need to be deep and have character. And I'm like, in my kind of growth as a teacher and as a writer, it's like, no, it's not either or, it's mm-hmm. both. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a choice. You have to choose to attack your weaknesses or to make sure that the side that's harder for you to do, that you work on that and make sure that, hey, my character study doesn't have to be boring and my genre piece doesn't have to be fluffy and light. I mean, L.A. Confidential, Lethal Weapon, Seven, Silence of the Lambs. I mean, these are some of the best Hollywood movies, you know, and they're genre movies. They don't compromise. They're not like, well, you know, Silence of the Lambs, we take away some thrills because we're so thematically profound. No.
No.
It's like, yes, and. It's like, you know, and this is what screenwriters say. Like, oh, well, I'm a first-time screenwriter, and I wanted to write something deep and dark. Fine, but is it fun? Does it hit the genre beats? I don't have to because I'm doing this extra stuff. It's like, no, man. Like, do that extra stuff. Do what's special to you, but then don't like shirk the responsibilities of like what that everybody has. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, my kind of thing is like, as a writer, you have a dilemma, and the choice is kind of like, no, man, do both. Like choose the hard choice of, you know, movies can be both things. They can do more than one thing at a time.
Well, no, absolutely. So what are some of the story elements that you find in today's blockbuster films that make it good? Because, I mean, look, Marvel obviously is, you know, has done something that nobody has ever done in the history of right. cinema. So they obviously are doing something right. Some of their movies are amazing. Some of them right. are not as good.
Well, off the top of your head, what are your favorite ones? Which ones work the most?
The ones that work the most are the one on a story point, the story, just on story and structure and script and screenwriting right. and storytelling, Winter Soldier. Okay. Is excellent, I thought, because Winter Soldier to me was just like just a good spy movie, like
okay.
kind of like The Dark Knight was a heist film,
right?
You know, you take Batman right. out of it, it's just a damn good heist film, you know.
It is, but it's funny because I'm like, the things I love about Dark Knight mm-hmm. are like. Or the things that like I don't like about Dark Knight or sometimes bog me down when I'm watching it again is the action sequences. I'm like, the character stuff and the theme stuff and like the dialogue is so amazing.
It's so good.
Then when they start like, forget the chase scene. Like, yeah, I know it's going to happen. It's well done. But I want to get back to the stuff. But about Winter Soldier though, okay, so give me, I mean, I've seen it once or twice. I haven't studied it. So give me like the one sentence log line of Winter Soldier. Just refresh me, and then
Winter Soldier. He's got to fight his because I haven't seen it in a bit. I just remember loving it. He has to fight not only he has to stand up for his ideals, but he also has to defend his best friend.
Stop. So right there. Hey, remember I said about a dilemma?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a strong dilemma there?
Very much so.
Yes, you said it. But even in your description, which was unprepared, and that's fine. It wasn't perfect. You immediately went to what resonated with you. It was like, man, a guy is caught between his values and fighting his friends versus his best friend, defending him, or defending his best friend versus what's supposed to be right. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, there you go.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I mean, so it's like once again, like I'm not the super commercial guy that's going to tell you, oh, these are the elements that make a
right. Hit these, cat, right?
But you know what though? But the things that make a story great or have potential to be great are those deep things like dilemma and character and theme. They have to resonate, and it obviously does in there. The early Spider-Man movies that Sam Raimi did.
Yeah, you know, the first two.
Alvin Sargent wrote them. I mean, the coming of age aspect, but the dilemma and his uncle teaching him the lesson, you know, with great response, with great repetition comes great redundancy. Just kidding. that shows up a few times. But actually, they somehow didn't make it in this last one. But the movies where the characters have something at stake, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's real. Now, once again, if you do those movies and they're boring and they're just a drama, I don't think that makes it, like, you know, like if I was the film snob, maybe I was in my 20s, and I said, well, that's what makes great movies. Well, no, that doesn't really make a great superhero movie, right? Right. But these movies have like we did with Superman, especially Dark Knight. I mean, these characters have really crisp and clear dilemmas. Things matter to them. You know, they relate to the real world. And it's like, these are the things that can make something powerful, that can anchor it, that can make it, once again, I don't know how to say popular. I don't know how to say, like, you know, commercial. But it makes it good at being a story. It makes it being good at what, like, you know, really pulls people in. So it's like.
Well, I mean, look at Iron Man. You know, which pretty much launched the Marvel Universe.
Right.
That was remarkable. I mean, a lot has to do with Robert Downey and his amazing performance of that character. But that character changes dramatically from the opening character to the one at the end of the movie. And he does have dilemma, and he does have, issues with who is the antagonist is. And it was really well done. What's your opinion?
Yes. And he has the foil character of, like, the father, who is the flat, I wouldn't say evil, but the flat, morally, like, limited or morally
ambiguous.
Right. They're deficient. I mean, the father made the choice of, like, make this stuff so I can make money. Like, like, he never had the conscience or the, you know, the doubt of his conscience. But he does. So it's like, there's a foil character. Are you going to go that way? You know, or are you going to go some, you know, perfect goody two shoe ways where you don't do it all? And he literally becomes like the Iron Man. He becomes the mixture. I mean, I don't even know if this is like on a conscious level, but like he becomes the machines and technology, and he becomes human. Like he's the Iron Human. So he's the guy who finds some way to bridge the technology and the power with
humanity.
Guess what? Well, with a heart, right?
Mm-hmm. Literally and figuratively.
Exactly. No, exactly. And the thing is, though, you're forcing me to talk about these things. You know, a lot of times I'll watch these movies and just have fun with them. But like, but if it works and you start thinking about why does it work, it's like there's a dilemma. He's both sides. He represents them. He's the only character who can straddle that. So it's like, you know, like a protagonist who can synthesize and be in two worlds at once. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of powerful. And there's really a lot of times where it makes someone special. And this isn't necessarily like some deep literary theory that like I espouse, but I mean, you know, it's other people have talked about this, but like okay, so Iron Man can be iron and technology and weapons, and he can be humor and he can have a heart. But you know, in Good Will Hunting, Will can be the blue collar guy who beats the crap out of a Harvard snob, and he can be the most efficiently productive mathematician in the world and solve problems that can save the world. And to have a character that can straddle things like that, meaning they're whole or they have the potential to be whole, that's really, you know, that's really kind of interesting. Because and even like in a this isn't a superhero film, but like a great genre film, Lethal Weapon.
Oh, Shane, right? Shane Black at his best.
Right. So, but like, okay, character dilemmas or character struggles. One character wants to live. I'm too old for this crap.
Right.
One character wants to die. Right.
Right.
Can you be more concise, you know, and specific? And it's like each of them has to grow to save the story. So I would say like the pretty much one of the times you have co-protagonists, like right before the climax of the movie, the daughter is taken, and it's the all is lost moment when not only are you physically, and this is back to the paradigms. So like the all is lost, rock bottom, dark cat of the soul, whatever Blake Snyder calls it. Yes, you need to be as far away as possible from the goal. So in Lethal Weapon, they've kidnapped the daughter. That's pretty far away, but that's necessary, but that's not sufficient. You also need to have the character the most furthest away psychologically, the most regressed, the furthest distance from where they need to be in order to save the day. So like in a love story, it's not only boy loses girl, boy becomes or girl becomes the worst version of themselves that aren't worthy of love, that couldn't win that love back, that don't deserve it. So Roger is lost his daughter, or his daughter's, you know, he needs to get her back, right? He's really far away from the goal. But he is by the book and safe because he wants to survive. And he has this guy in front of him who's presenting the attitude of lethal weapon, whatever, to kill. And he says, you have to do it. And it's really, you know, and it's really like great craft because it's foreshadowing. It's alley it's set up. He's like, you have to listen to me. We shoot to kill. We take no prisoners. We got to risk this crap. That's the only possible way. And he believes him and trusts him. And they go in. And even though it doesn't work right away, like he has to grow and learn from him in order to have a chance to save the day, in order to kind of kick butt at the end and save the day. And it's like, well, wait a second. But yeah, well, what did Riggs have to do? Well, a scene before that, when they fake his death, remember? Right? The reason why they can fake his death is he gets shot, he goes through the glass, and Roger goes over to him, worried about him, and he's like, surprise, you wore the bulletproof vest. You have proven that you love yourself and life again, that you're not self-destructive, that you're not suicidal. I trust you now. So when you say we got to risk because it's the right thing to do, I can believe you now, because now I don't think you're that self-destructive suicide thing that I was like ready to, you know, kill or hate, you know, 30, 40, 50 minutes ago in the story. So it's like he needed to do that and have that growth so that Roger would then accept his risk-taking attitude as not as self-destructive, suicidal stupidity, but as like a conscious, clear choice that he's making now as his friend. So it's like, you see how like in this, hey man, it's just fun and people getting shot and kidnapping and shooting stuff. No, it's also this character stuff. And it's like the same thing as superhero movies, man. Like, I don't know. Like, it's like, there are people who probably specialize in talking about, oh, the elements of the universe, and they can compare those movies. And when a client comes to me with that kind of story, we'll pick two or three movies and we'll look at them and I'll break them down. And I'll kind of like, you know, when I put my mind to something, to see something, I'll see stuff that other people don't see and we'll find that. But like, all I can say is like, you know what, if you want to write that superhero movie, here's what a good movie is. Here's what a good story is. And don't think that you can't have themes and foil characters.
No, you have to.
Don't think that it can't be unified, because, you know, the dilemma and the specificity of the character is what brings unity to everything. And that unity is what kind of, you know, brings you power. So it's like,
well, I mean, it's a perfect example. And I use this example a lot on the show, as I've said this before, is like, you look at the Avengers and then you look at the Justice League.
Right.
And one failed, one launched an entire universe that made billions and billions of dollars. So to analyze the two of them and how both of those films, what led up to both of those films, you can obviously see so clearly where one, you were so emotionally connected to all the characters because you had already went on individual journeys with all of them. Right. As opposed to the other one where you kind of knew somebody and then there was a new Batman that no one ever knew. You know, like
– It's interesting you say that, because you're talking about, you know, the level of how good a movie can be is based on the antagonist. Wasn't the antagonist the stupidest antagonist ever?
Like, well,
he wanted to have some power and do stuff. Like, I mean, like, what was right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, like they were trying to
rush.
They were doing fun stuff like Superman coming back and being a temporary obstacle. You know, like that was interesting, I guess, or scary or interesting.
Sure.
But then it's like that was more interesting than the dilemma or the meaning of trying to kill the other dude. I mean, the bad guy was like, well, yeah, kill him because he's a dude. And like, oh, yeah, you all have complementary skills and you'll use different ones. Well, that's interesting for like a 7 or 12 minute cartoon. But like, it doesn't really, right? But I mean, like, oh, we all have special skills. We're going to come together and do it. Like,
it's the A-team.
You know, that was the 60s Patrick McNee Avengers, you know, like for a 47 minute British spy show. But it's, that doesn't fly today. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just interesting enough. And actually, you know, if you want to tangent on this, you know, Fincher and some of the genre stuff might be a great, because I know you're a Fincher
I'm a
fan.
Huge Fincher
so
fan.
So in one of the movies I was talking about, a Seven, so
yeah.
We don't necessarily have to do it this moment, but like at some point we can kind of like segue over, because I think he's a good example of like the best genre Hollywood movie making, but that doesn't sacrifice these higher, you know,
these higher things. Oh, I mean, look at Fight Club. I mean, look at Gone Girl. I mean, look at any of his work, The Game.
Right.
You can create a spectacle, but yet have so much depth in character and theme and hidden things that you will see years later. Like, I could watch Fight Club now.
Right.
And it's a different movie than I saw when it came out.
Right. And I'll tell you what, Fight Club is a movie that I watched once or twice. Love it. I recognize it's brilliant. I just never really kind of had a reason or like, to like, I don't want to say ruin it, but like, I just never studied it to death. Like I get it, the ultra ego stuff. And on our second viewing, it has extra levels because all the setup for the, you know, like he'll do the fight scene with the guy and then he'll do the point of view of him fighting himself, right? But that's brilliant. I mean, that's how you, like, if you can get surprise and twist in scenes that are completely based on setup from what you've already shown us, then that scene doesn't need setup and exposition. It just is. And then the power is that you're seeing it with already a set of expectations and already an understanding of what you want to get from it and why the things you see are surprising. So rather than having to have the moment where you explain why this next scene coming up is interesting or what people want in it, it's already in the texture of the movie. And talk about – I'll tell you what. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about Fincher for a second.
Yeah, please.
Let me disclaim this. I don't think that my appreciation for Fincher or my finding some common ground with obviously what I feel like is his ethos of filmmaking. I'm not saying I'm as good as that or I'm worthy or whatever. I'm just saying it's like I watch his stuff and it's like if I had written the perfect screenwriting manifesto and put it out in the world, it was as if like he embraced it, because he never ever violates a principle that I teach. Mm-hmm. And it's like I'm actually more proud of myself that like I've come up with like all my theories and stuff, and then one of the greatest filmmaker storytellers, you know, alive working right now seems to kind of, you know, implicitly almost prove or show that I'm on the right track in some way. Like he just won't. So like, for instance, like I say, opening image is always right on.
Of course.
You remember the opening image for Gone Girl?
I don't off the top of my head. I don't remember.
It's in a book too. So good for her, because you know, the author was doing this, but it's the picture of the wife's head. And he's like, I want to get in that head. And it's like, oh my God, he means psychologically understand her to see if emotions, because she's a sociopath. But it might mean, and it does mean, I want to crack it open. And or that's what you're supposed to think it means. It's like, oh my God, in like an image in 5 seconds, this movie has already announced what it's about, what it's going to be about. Like the irony of like the two of like, well, wait a second, is she getting in her head like, you know, figuratively, or did he break into her head? So it's like, it's so right on. So like, and same thing, introduction to characters, like in The Game, which I haven't really studied that much, but like one time I said, you know, Fincher always introduces his characters very, very, very concisely. Mm-hmm. So I said, one of the first images of the Michael Douglas character is that beautiful shot of San Francisco down the hill, and his car is smoothly in the grooves of the, trolley tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, this guy's an autopilot. He's like, he's on the tracks. He's going straight forward. And there's no whole lot of thought. And someone said, oh my God, no, that's, you're so reading into it. That's so like stereotypically, you know, bad teacher story analyst, like reading stuff. Okay. I'm like, okay. So let's just imagine that I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that when he introduces character, he doesn't make them so specific and so unique to the character. Okay, well, how do they introduce the brother? Oh, on the phone call. Oh, line two, your brother. No, line two, a guy named Seymour Butts. So he's already playing jokes. He's already a practical joker before we even see him. Mm-hmm. And the brother instantly knows, okay, that's my brother because my brother plays jokes. And then in the restaurant – and I mean this takes some work. I don't know if it's in the script. Mm-hmm. But as he's walking up to him, Sean Penn has – or he grabs it off a – or maybe he has it with him. He has a spray bottle with him. And he goes up to him and he sneezes and sprays on his brother. Right? But that's like a pretty extreme specific thing. Why is that? Because he's a trickster. He plays games. He's a practical joker. And you need that because you know what? The entire movie is going to be based on you believing that this guy would spend, I don't know, $100,000 to play a joke, a game with his brother. If that's not the essence of the character, if he's not someone who lives and breathes and walks and talks like that, mm-hmm. it's like, well, yeah, believability. But here's the thing. You might say, well, that's too far and that's not incredible. And that always lost me. Fine. But you know what? The filmmakers were good storytellers. They did everything they could do to make that kind of work. So it's like, so it's all there. So, So opening images and introductions of characters. Can I talk about that for a second?
Sure, please.
Okay. So, you know, I always talk about opening images being like so powerful and so important. And then I tell writers, you know, writers say, well, how long do I have to do it? And they're like a page, a paragraph, two pages. Well, Andrew Kevin Walker in his draft of Seven created an on-point opening image that did what I'm telling you that they should do in the first five words. He says, light fights through the soot, right? Mm-hmm. Darkness, light, trying to find light. And then I think in his draft, at some point, Somerset takes a switchblade and scrapes away grime mm-hmm. off the wall. There's a mm-hmm. rose there. Mm-hmm. So this idea of, you know, light trying to fight through the darkness, good trying to find good and through evil, all that stuff. That's right there. So he did his job as a screenwriter. Like he knew what his movie was about and he did it in five words, right? Right? I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, you can almost say, you know, it's dark, you know, it's about darkness. You probably even know, like, it's a mystery because what's, you know, what's shrouded in darkness and, you know, a story about light and darkness, you know? So it's like, it gives away, it tells you the genre, it tells you the themes, and it's going to actually tell you about the character in a second too. Well, Fincher did something a little more specifically, which is what you're supposed to do. And this is what you can do as a writer. Like you look at your first draft and you say, oh, well, it takes me a page and a half to get to my like theme and all the stuff. But Jim says it should be done in a couple sentences. And mm-hmm. Citizen Kane does it like in a couple sentences. Citizen Kane, like no trespassing, right? right? No trespassing. The fence. Guess what? The camera moves up and over it, and you're gonna invade this guy's life, and you're gonna like, you know, that was the whole point of the movie. Like you're gonna like violate this guy's life, and you're gonna mm-hmm. think that you could figure out what's going on. So Fincher takes some of the ideas in that draft, and he does something really specific. So the very first shot is rather than trying to kind of, you know, I don't have it to show, and I'm not gonna lull you into it. It has a shot where Somerset walks in, pours out coffee, walks out, but he's framed between two very peculiar and specific things. And the background is the window with the sounds of the city. And the script had set up that the sounds of the city were there and he was trying to block them out. And it was like chaos and it was like the evil world and stuff. Mm-hmm. And in front of it is something that I couldn't quite tell what it was. But then I looked really closely and it's a chess set. So I'm just mm-hmm. going to lead you to it. So in the very first frame, in the very first shot, you have a character who's visually caught between unknowing chaos, evil that's out there, you can't know, it's uncontrollable, or a finite, logical, complete information world where wisdom can win, where there's a clear winner and you can do it. Because like chess is like an interesting game. Because chess, you have perfect information. Unlike poker, where you don't see the other person's cards, mm-hmm. you see, I mean, how you got right. Right, but how you got there maybe affects it. But like you see everything that's available to anybody right there on the thing. So right there he sets it up. So it's like – sorry, I bumped the mic.
It's all good.
So immediately he sets it up and you say, well, once again, Jim, you're being a little bit too much. I'm like, okay, just let's stick with me for a second. Let's say it's the chaos and the evil and the unknowing. Let's call chaos versus the order versus wisdom and experience and knowledge can win, right? Let's say chaos and order for a second, right? Well, the very first shot of him getting ready for work, which getting for work, ready for work, showing he's a cop, that's necessary, but it's not sufficient. You want to do more than that. It happens to show him picking a piece of lint off his jacket. So it's order. And then the next shot, which is order, but ironically, it's order and has chaos within it. It shows the five or six tools of his trade, a pen, the badge, a switchblade, a notebook, right? Mm-hmm. And they're all lined up. So as content, it's, oh, that's order. He has these things all lined up, right? So it's the first shot was chaos versus order. That's the question. Then it's order the way he gets dressed. Then it's order, but surprise. Within that order is the badge and the notebook and the pen versus the switchblade, right? Mm-hmm. Right, violence versus order, or you know, knowledge and taking notes in the pen versus a switchblade, and then it goes back to him getting dressed, and it's once again, what part of getting dressed? It's him adjusting his tie, right? So it's back to order. It's not just, oh, I'm putting on my pants, or this is my badge, this is my uniform. It's you couldn't show a more specific, orderly aspect of getting dressed, right? So then, if I'm right, right before he walks out and the sequence is over, we're gonna hit, the note of order chaos again, right? Mm-hmm. Well, as he walks by his bed. The camera pans and lands on something. Do you remember what it lands on?
Don't off the top of my head.
It lands on a metronome.
Oh, yes.
Right. So, and actually in the writer's draft, the metronome is there literally the most specific, unique, most powerful example of what order is, right? Mm-hmm. And he's using it to try to go to sleep. It might even resonate with the way puppies, you put a ticking clock with a group of puppies and makes it sound like their mother's heart. It might even have more resonance, but he's sitting there listening to the metronome to block out the sounds coming in from the window. So all those ideas were there, but look how what Fincher did. Chaos and order in a shot, then order, which has some chaos in it, then order, then complete order, then the absolute next shot is a jaggedly framed image of a bloody dead body. So in content and form, chaos, mm-hmm. right? So metronome to bloody red body. So it's in a true romance. So am I lying when I see, tell me if I'm lying, chaos and order, that unity and specificity is so right there. And Fincher is he's like a precision surgeon where it's nothing is wasted. And mm-hmm. Then later on, we'll see that the floor of his kitchen is checkerboard, right? At one point, he gets frustrated and he throws his switchblade and or the metronome mm-hmm. onto the checkerboard, right? So he's colliding these things. And it's once again, this rule of well, if you know what your opening image is supposed to do and you know how fast you can get to it and you know you can introduce characters, the very first thing you see about them, here's a guy who's struggling to keep things in order and believe that he can, with tick-tock approach to the world, he can save things. Here's a guy struggling with that, right? Mm-hmm. And it's all there. 30, 40 seconds, 7 shots, 10 different paradigms. So if you see that specificity and that's your job to be so specific, mm-hmm. right? So so you do it, your first draft not going to do it, your second draft not going to do it. Then you're going to sit around and your beginning writer, your third time writer, you're like, okay, well, I got to aim for that. So then you write a version that's a little bit on the nose, but you're getting closer. But you're not going to let that go. You're not going to think, oh, I'm done. Mm-hmm. Until it does what that does. So it's these ideas of dilemma and knowing things and specificity, they turn into magic. They turn into the elements in the scenes that make your story kind of special and unique. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I know a lot of people listening will probably think, oh, I think Jim's going a little too deep on Fincher. As far as I think he's reading into stuff that Fincher's doing. But I would say from my point of view that you are not, because everything that Fincher right. does has right, right. purpose.
Well, listen, okay, so if Jim Mercurio can come up with this and you believe some of it, so guess what? David Fincher is better at this than I am. David Fincher
is a master.
I mean, some people have been criticizing him. He's too cool, he's too intellectual. But so already you have a guy who working in commercials has already worked on the smallest, shortest forms known as a monster for details. Mm-hmm. And it if someone in the world is going to do a perfect movie or a perfect sequence, we're going to do something where nothing is wasted, why wouldn't it be one of the top 2 or 3 directors working, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's like you know, no, trust me, he's doing that. And it's like, once again, if you think I'm wrong, go pick the top 10 movies or be a film snob and tell me the top five movies that you think are the greatest movies of all time. And I promise you 8 or 9 of them will have that amazingly succinct introduction to character, that amazingly succinct opening. Because it's like, wait a second. So you tell me the guy who has her head in voiceover, I want to get inside that head as the very first 5 seconds of Gone Girl, doesn't know what he's doing and isn't in control of what he's doing. No. Right? Right.
All you got to do is watch Seven and Fight Club and Social Network and all of them.
No, exactly. Exactly. Same thing with Social Network. You know, he has an 8-minute-long scene, right? The talking scene.
Yes.
But then I say an opening image sums it all up. So you say, well, Jim, that was an opening image. That was 8 pages of talk. Well, first of all, if you listed the 10 things opening image is supposed to do, that does 8 of them. Sets up the world, sets up the rules. Okay. But then in the script, there's like 4 or 5 lines, 3 little paragraphs of him walking back to get to the dorm. And it says, and the only place he feels comfortable. Fincher turned that into like a $3 million sequence. It's one of the biggest sequences of the movie. He goes through Harvard. Every single moment, someone's doing something, always in couples, go in the opposite direction. No one's ever going the right direction. Oh, well, that's you picking on it. Well, okay, look at the 17 shots and tell me, how come never one person is alone, never one person is pointing in the same direction or moving in the same direction? He's going against all that stuff. He gives you the opening image second. But he goes through, and even though he kind of doesn't have to, because he probably nailed it in all the dialogue.
Oh, he set then it up. Yeah. Sorkin
he then spends 90 seconds. Well, Sorkin does, but Fincher decided to spend 2 minutes of the film in like 4 days of shooting in a $2 million sequence of him going right.
Right.
It was so important to get him across there and show that and set him up. So it's like, once again, tell me I'm not lying. Like so. Yeah, he broke the rules about opening images. No, he didn't. He bent the rules and then did exactly what I said you should do and he should do. So it's like, yeah, he broke the rules, bent the rules. But guess what? He did everything we just said we should do. So it's like, you know, I playfully challenge you, you know, or at some point, if we do a follow-up, like, you know, let's think about 10 classic movies of all time and just ask yourself, wait a second, did they do that?
Yeah.
Did those filmmakers do that? And you're going to find always that, you know, pretty much always that it's right there that, you know, the filmmakers are doing that. It's funny because I sometimes do – people say, Jim, you go too far, because as a filmmaker, I definitely bring kind of filmmaking and understanding of like all the other parts of filmmaking, editing and lighting and you know, cinematography. I bring that into my screenwriting teaching. And if you were to say, well, here's where most people say screenwriting ends and directing and filmmaking kind of begin, you know, on a scale from 1 to 100, let's say like screenwriters end at 40 and then the process, filmmaking process takes over. Right. Mm-hmm. Now there's definitely gonna be times when I might talk, maybe some of what I was talking about, maybe some of it is a little bit more of the filmmaker stuff, like the checkered floor is probably filmmaker stuff. But let's say I talk about stuff that's in the 80s, 90s, and like, you know what, that's definitely director stuff. But I'll tell you what, almost or 9 out of 10 screenwriters would be better off, you know, misfiring in my direction, starting or trying to put a little bit too much or worrying about a little bit too much details, because a movie is what you see and what you hear. Mm-hmm. The only difference is on a screenwriter has the page, a director has the whole actual canvas in the screen to do it. But it's like most screenplays are not as visual as they could be. They're not using as many of the tools and understanding of what, you know, kind of what film can do. So it's like, I definitely believe that on average, screenwriters need to come more in my direction and kind of take more responsibility for the visuals and images and details that they put on the page. And if they overshoot by a little bit, fine. It's really easy to cut back.
Oh, it's much easier. It's much easier to pull back than it is to push.
And the thing is, though, I promise you almost, you know, 99 of 100 screenwriters would be better off if they err a little bit more, assuming I'm wrong, or towards my side of like, well, wait a second, go a little bit further than what the screenwriting books tell you as far as what you can do. Because, you know, if you can nail how someone dresses, how it sums them up, then, you know, kind of put that in there. And it's like, or if you even know, wait a second, I know that wardrobe is something that I can use. So like in Dark Knight, remember he goes to the Matthew Modine character and he says, it's not like I'm expecting you to walk down Main Street with your dress blues on or, you know, your fancy, you know, outfit. Guess what? Then in the climax or later on in the movie, his character has on that blue outfit. Mm-hmm. He's walking down the street. So it's like, oh, he did do the most audacious, bold thing that he was challenged to do. He actually did that. So like the fact that you knew wardrobe could have a meaning, but and actually what you did more so than the wardrobe was you use foreshadowing and, mm-hmm. you know, and words to charge that item. But it's like, you see how like you can do something that maybe another person, another writer wouldn't have done, but like I don't think that's outside the realm of screenwriting. That should be part of screenwriting. And if you're doing those kind of specific things, you're going to be a better storyteller than the average, the average writer.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Well, just nowadays, as spec scripts, I mean, you just have to execute it. Like, there's no development money. People don't want to develop stuff. They want it to be on the page. So you want to write, like, actor bait. You want to write director bait. You want to write scripts that are like, oh, hey, you know what? This is on the page. This could be shot in 3 weeks. I could send this out to directors. I could send this out to actors. Like, so, like, my focus on scene writing in the nitty-gritty details that I focus on, because the best thing I can do for you business-wise is help you write and execute the script that's in your head, the script that you want to write. Because if you can nail it and make it really attractive to all the other allies you need, like an agent can say, wow, this is really – these set piece scenes are really showy. I could send this to a director. Or this role is really fun and those monologues are great and there's some set piece scenes for the actor to do. I know actors who would play this. If you can get that in your storytelling and mm-hmm. your execution, you were so far ahead of the game, because – people don't want to develop stuff. They're not buying concepts anymore. It's not like the 90s where like a log line and a concept, you know.
We get $1 million.
Exactly. So you have to nail. You have to be great. You have to be both sides. Yeah, it's genre. Yeah, it transcends the genre. Guess what? It's great characters. It's great themes. It's roles that people would want to play. So like you have to be all things.
Without question. Now, do you suggest writers outline their screenplays?
Of course, but once again, like it's a back and forth process. Like, I listened to one of your podcasts, and someone was saying, you know, writers make mistakes because they don't do enough preparation. They don't outline enough. But here's the thing, they don't. That's true. But also, they can't because, like, to do it right, to develop a story that's both working on the external level and the internal level, which is what your goal is. Like, a lot of times the people talk different ways. Like, you want a story that has resonates or that's deeper or that has meaning or has theme. That really what it means is that every step of the way, there's an internal journey, an external journey. And it's like, you can't do that right away. So it's like writers should work on structure and they should be prepared, but then they write a little bit and then they stumble upon and discover turning points. And things that come next. And then they can use that to augment and expand their outline. And as long as they don't like, you know, write 30, 40 pages really fast and then get stuck to it and say, these pages aren't going anywhere, but are willing to look at that as like, that's kind of your outlining, mm-hmm. you know? And you discover, so you write 10, 15 pages, you might discover a turning point after writing 10 pages, and you throw away all those pages, but now you know the turning point you're aiming to with a Fincher-like precision, and like that created your outline. So those 2 days of writing weren't wasted. They help you write an outline that covers 10% of your script, right? But you had to write 10 pages and throw them away. So it's like, it's a back and forth. It's a chicken egg. So like, you always want to ask yourself what happens next. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm just trying to build good habits. Your scene should always have a change that is a story and the character. Also, another way to think about it, what happens next, but also a different way to think about it is, what would my character do next? And if you can follow those things and align them, that's the skill it takes to be a good storyteller. That's not something that's going to happen the first time you sit down. It's not something that you're going to be able to do for like outlining a 100-page story. So it's like, if you know that's your goal, and you have the habit of like, well, okay, the next thing is he has to go after and interrogate these people. Okay, that's generic. Well, how does he do it? Well, now he's really impatient, or now he's mad. Now he's willing to break the law. You know, so it's like a perfect example is in LA Confidential. You know, he was told earlier, would you rough up somebody to get a confession? No, I wouldn't do that. When he goes to rough up the DA with Bud White, Mm-hmm. And Bud, like, it's perfect because Bud White's the mentor leading the way. He's like, on your journey to quit being the goody two shoes, quit being the superego and getting your hands dirty, here's the second or third step before the very end. So we're going to take you on that journey. You're going to get information from the DA that turns the story, but you're going to do it in a way that's really fun because it's new to you. Like, you haven't done it before. It represents growth. It represents, like, you moving in the right direction. So it's like, that's a perfect example of, like, the story, external stuff, and the inner journey, internal, emotional character arc stuff. You want to put those together. And yes, you do want to be prepared. You do have to have preparation, but don't lock yourself into thinking, I'm going to nail it all in the structure and the outline stage. No, you are working for what I call, like, a phantom treatment or phantom outline. It's something that grows and builds as you're writing. Mm-hmm. But don't be afraid to explore a little bit, but then come back and explore a little bit, come back, because it's going to take work the first few times to get, you know, all these things working. And that's back to the thing about, a lot of times writers don't even know what they're aiming for. Mm-hmm. If you're a first-time writer, you don't know you're aiming for that. You don't know, like, that the next step of, oh, the cop has to interrogate the people also has to have some personal character aspect specific to your flaw. Or the antagonist has to make it harder in some way that's specific to that character. So it's like, you know, first-time screenwriter, maybe they don't know that's not, like, just a lofty goal. That's the bare minimum. Like, that's what storytelling is. That's what great storytelling is. So it's like, yeah, they have to, but also, you know, it's not about rigidly, like, oh, okay, just commit to it. And because you say you're going to do it, you can just magically have those skills. They need to develop over time.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about your new book, The Craft of Scene Writing?
Yeah, it's actually the first ever book that focuses, you know, just on scenes. Mm-hmm. And at first, you know, I was defensive about it, like, oh, it's just for people who do short form stuff, commercial stuff. But then as I wrote it, I kind of realized, no. A scene is, you know, a really small unit. I mean, a beat is the smallest unit, like a little change, a little moment, and then a few beats lead up to a change, and that's a scene. But a scene is the first unit of drama that's a story in and of itself. It's storytelling in its purest form. Mm-hmm. You're leading up to a change, and the craft to turn that change, to understand that climax, like I just said, to make the character and story change, that's a skill that's probably the most important skill in screenwriting. And people will say, oh, Jim, you're being too extreme. No. I mean, your climax of your movie is where your character arc comes and, like, the clever solution. Guess what that is? That's the story change and that's the character change. I call it the killer ending, where the goal and the need, the external and the internal, unify into one succinct action that aligns them, that pulls them together. So it's like, if you can turn a moment using both character and story, and you do it perfectly, perfectly means you've drawn from character. Mm-hmm. You've drawn from the deep recesses of the character. You've drawn from the clever setup that you created. You know what I'm saying? Like in Fight Club, when he has that fight with himself and you see just him.
Right.
Right. Well, that scene works, and the surprise comes from the fact that you saw the fight the first time, right, without it. Or I know you know what? I know, you know, like an 8 Mile, I know everything you have to say about me. I know your favorite movie is Shawshank Redemption.
Yes.
But look at – I mean, that's a movie that a lot of its success is having great scenes. It's so carefully planned out. Oh. So think about how carefully it's orchestrated. They decide to switch – well, they switch the perspective a few times, but they decide to show the escape from the warden's perspective. So it's a mystery. It's a suspense.
Right.
And we see him come up. And so then when you're ready to show it later on, which is a really conscious choice, it's like a scene writing choice, but also, like, on a one level, the scene or sequence where it's shown now has power because of the setup you created for it. It has a couple of things. It answers the question of, hey, how did that happen? But also, because Red's telling the story in voiceover, it actually has an extra level to it. So it's like, if you can nail scenes and understand how structurally they work, that's going to help your scenes be sharper and crisper. That's going to help your sequences. That's going to help your acts. It's going to help your entire story. So it's like, if I see 3 or 4 scenes, the first few pages are all wishy-washy and the climax has fat after it, it's not concise, I know, why would I think that your climax is going to be any different? Because that's all it is. It's just it's a change. It's a reversal. So, yeah, I feel like my focus on craft is something that I do that's kind of special. And I think writers will get something really unique out of my really kind of microscopic approach. And it's not a niche. It's really something that's really super universal. And I'm hoping that it'll kind of get people kind of excited. And it'll be like a new canonical book. Because, I mean, all the great, great screenwriting books, like, if I were to list them, all but one or two are from like, you know, I don't know, 30 years ago. I mean, you still go back to, right? You still go back to Walter Haig, Field in some ways.
Truby,
I mean,
right.
Right. I mean, but McKee's book is solid. He's good, but that's hard to read. Like, I can't say, hey, first time screenwriter, go read McKee.
It is. Yeah, McKee is not an easy digestion.
I mean, like me, as a teacher, I got to read it, or someone who like is trying to synthesize all this stuff, of course. Whereas an advanced screenwriter, you might do it, but you know, it's hard. And the very first thing in my book, now anyway, this epigraph. The epigraph in my book, a little quote in the front of my book, is from Renoir, Pierre Auguste Renoir. It says, "First, learn to be a craftsman. It won't keep you from being a genius." So it's like learning this stuff, seeing what other people do, like it's not going to prevent you from using your intuition or every piece of talent you have. If I tell you your opening image has to augur the theme and be right on, like what are you going to argue? Well, no, I thought I'd start my movie off with some junk that doesn't really nail it, doesn't really belong to it. Well, if that's the case, guess what happens? You cut that. You know, like if you have that in your script, well, cut. Oh, here's where the story becomes itself. Here's where the story presents itself and its themes and what it's about and its essence. Mm-hmm. That's where you start your movie. Why would you start with that? So it's like, even if you follow my rule and do that, you still have to have the magic. You still have to find the way, the clever, unique way of being on point and saying, hey, show me, or I'm going to show you the essence of my movie in a sentence or an image, right? Or three sentences. And you're going to go back on a second or third reading, you're going to know, or you're going to appreciate, oh my God, this movie is what it was about, knew what it was about from the very first frame, from the very first story. That's something that is hard to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
In your great movie that you love, not you, but like the movies that like, you know, aspiring writers or beginning writers love, mm-hmm. they probably do that and they're not even aware. Right. And that's the thing. So the very first thing I can do is say, man, appreciate this craft. Look, like, let me be anal and show it to you. And it's like the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. If you know it exists, it should change your world. Like, if you know that 9 out of 10 of your favorite movies do these things,
mm-hmm.
what are you fighting against? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's hard. It'd be easier not to. Shortcuts are obviously shortcuts. What? But
well, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but like it's a perfect example of like if you don't know what the hero's journey was, if the hero's journey has never been brought to you or even brought into your world, imagine when you first heard about the hero's journey, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. Like it changed everything, whether you use it or not, but you know it's there.
Once again, you can steal from all the stuff. So it's like, okay, so we know stories go up and down. We know things have to go down. So, okay. Dark Night of the Soul and Jim's rock bottom. Character goes down and he's far away from the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And psychologically, he's regressed to be his worst self. Like Bud White. Bud White goes and punches his girlfriend in the face. He becomes his father. He becomes the worst version of himself before he goes on and then starts thinking and helping out with Exley. He goes from his very worst to his character arc. Like that's the twist and that's the, you know, surprise reversal that I talk about in my film with like, you know, with great detail. Like if you can do it with a line of dialogue or a couple words of action description, then you can do it with an entire story. So this is back to the yes end. So like, you know, stories go up and down. And you know at some point the character's going to be farther away from the goal and also regress to the worst self. Like in LA Confidential, Bud White punches his girlfriend in the face, becomes his father. He becomes his worst self the moment – like the split second before he becomes the character arc of like, you know, helping out, using his brain, not being like this angry id-like creature. So let's say you know that and you have that in your story. But then you read Vogler and then you think about mythology and then you think Phoenix rising from the ashes. Oh, well, that's like a cool image. So like in one of the Spider-Man movies, something crashes in on Peter and then boom, he jumps up and all this stuff flies out. And like to me, I always thought of like, oh, it's like the Phoenix rising from the ashes. So like you may get an idea for an image or a beat from like one of these paradigms. And it's not like, oh, well, I was never, ever going to know about this beat. But it might just give you like a specific idea or it might just give you a specific way through it. Or my challenge to say, okay, make him the furthest away possible from the goal. You know, if you're the guy who's writing a drama, you might be able to say, okay, I need to push the story further away. Or if you're the guy who writes the story, roller coaster, obstacle course movies, you might say, wait a second, regression psychology, I didn't think about that.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take – I got to think about that for a second. What is the worst thing that could possibly – you know, and it's like – some little paradigm or some little specific insight or example might give you a scene or a visual or just open up something for you. So it's like it's to me like if any of these paradigms resonate with you, it just means they're working. It just means because they're all metaphors. So like if it resonates with you, it just means there's some truth to the metaphors. It's mapping somewhat accurately or some truth and honesty the storytelling thing. I don't think any of them are perfect. I don't think mine's perfect, or I don't think any of them are necessarily complete. But if like all of them do 80%, or if all of them have some good things you can pull from them, like yeah, definitely learn from 10 different places. That's how, you know, I mean that's how I became like a good teacher. It's like I went down all these paths and all these different perspectives, and I said to myself, well, I'll take the best and leave the rest of all of these. I'll collide them. I'll compare them. And like I kind of came up with this like creative like way of like, you know what? I don't think my stuff violates or goes against or puts anything down that's out there. Mm-hmm. I just think it also will add something specific and give you different new tools no matter where you are, what paradigm you're thinking about. I believe mine will complement it. So it's like I'm kind of a positive guy. I want it to be yes and. I want you to do all things. I don't want you to do just one thing. I don't want you to do just my paradigm. I don't want to say Michael Haig's better than Truby. I think there's Haig stuff that's good. I think there's Truby stuff that's good. And there's my stuff that's good. Look at it all, but I would rather you say yes to like seven things out of us than say, well, I say yes to three of those things, but the other things are kind of counterintuitive and hard for me. Mm-hmm. So I'm just not going to make that policeman threshold guardian. I'm just not going to give a big psychological resonance. I'll just make it funny. It's like, no, man, like you lost the battle right there. Right. It's like you can't take away. In fact, every time you take away from something, you have to add more and probably even add more than you take away. And even like sometimes like, you know, Robert Altman used to make these like deconstructions of genres where he mm-hmm. would like trim stuff down and take things away. But I would argue as an art filmer, as a smart guy, or as an experimental filmmaker, he was adding way more than he was taking away. So it's like you always want to look for like, you know, ways to say yes and. Yeah, I'll do what everybody else does, and then I'll transcend it, and then I'll go deeper in these areas that usually most people don't do. It's like you want to be able to set yourself apart. You want to aim to be great. Your expectations have to be, you know, shouldn't be aiming like, oh, I'm going to do like a cool buddy cop movie that's kind of funny or that's kind of reminiscent of Lethal Weapon. It's like, no, right nowadays, you got to write something that's better than Lethal Weapon or as good as Lethal Weapon or that's the modern day version of Lethal Weapon. It's like you have to kind of go for it.
All right, man. So I'm going to ask you the same questions I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
Well, like I said, I mean, just go. I mean, start writing. Understand that your writing process yourself is going to lead you to things. Like there are things you only learn from writing. So write, read screenplays, read some books, or read parts of books, or read some blogs, and just go back and forth with it. And it's like you're going to do all these things at once because the more you know of, the more you're aware of, if you go and read an article, analyze a screenplay, and like he points something out that Fincher does, now you know it's possible you could do that. If another guy gives you a good idea about how to break in your second act, well, that's cool. If you read three scripts and you see every single modern comedy has an exciting incident in the first 8 pages rather than 11, then you can, you know what I'm saying? Like mm-hmm. just go blindly forward for a while and things will start catching up and kind of aligning and accruing. And like, don't think that there's one way I must outline and must rigidly plan, or I must just write from the seat of my pants because I'm a genius. The answer isn't no to that, no to this. It's yes and yes. Right. Yeah, write some. Don't be afraid to throw it away. You know, discover, go back and let that be your structure. And then, you know, one of the people you can come to is me. I have this big, huge 10-hour DVD set. Right. My book eventually, or, you know, I work with clients that have made billions of dollars in box office and complete beginners. So it's like, you know, that is something I do. You can check out my website for that.
Now, can you tell me what book had the biggest impact on your life or career?
Screenwriting book?
Either screenwriting or any other kind of book.
You know, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if the how-to books did. I mean, when I was in college and writing my first screenplay, like I went to the bookstore and there was 2 or 3 books on the shelf. So I picked up like, I think Walter and Field. Mm-hmm. And they were like incomplete, but they were solid. And they were like, you know, they gave me a framework I don't have a good answer.
If you don't have a good answer, we can move on. It's all good.
I think of the screenwriting books. I think Michael Haig's writing screenplays that sell really started aligning theme and character with the story. I love that. And I think Linda Sager's book, Making a Good Script Great, which is actually in some ways not because of her writing, but because of the complexity and the details. It's a hard read. You actually need to have watched the movie, almost have it in front of you, and almost outline it, because to really understand what she's saying, the setups and payoffs and nitpicky stuff, you really have to kind of know it. And in my book, I do the same kind of stuff where it's like, I'm going to give five examples, and three of them are going to be like, oh, I'm not sure about that movie. But the two that you know are going to be so specific and so on point. So her book was very specific and really about showing you how movies are about setups and payoffs. Mm-hmm. I think that was very powerful. Okay. And then when I was a director, a friend of mine who was producing the movie said, you don't know the actor language. You don't know how to talk to actors yet. And he made me read this book called Audition by Michael Shurtleff. Mm-hmm. And it was like how actors prepare.
Yeah.
And what it did was, the book is amazing. It's helped me amazing. Helped me my writing to take those principles. But the idea that you must consider the other perspectives of other people, cinematographer, editor, actors, if you understand their point of view better, it makes you a better screenwriter. Not just on some theoretical, like, intellectual level, but like on a deep personal emotional level. If you know that actor playing that small role is a person and is invested and is going to spend 40 hours making up a backstory for the guy who gives the tickets out on the boat, you're going to put more emphasis and details and thought into your minor characters, because you know an actor, a real live person, is going to play it. So like sympathy and empathy and understanding for those other things intellectually and emotionally, like that was a book that was like first opened me up to that mindset.
Very cool. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Let's see. I think it's that yes and, or do both. Like for 10 years, I was making movies, 2000 to 2010, I was making low budget movies. And, you know, there's this thing called deliberate practice. Like I was learning to be a better screenwriter and I was learning to be a better teacher. And it wasn't like that time was wasted, but I think I wasn't writing as much during that time, because I said to myself, well, I'm making movies, so I don't have to be the writer all the time too. Mm-hmm. I don't have to crank out scripts, you know, as the guys who aren't also spending 5,000 hours making movies. And it's like, no, you know what, man, it's hard, but you have to do both. Same thing with, I want to write action movies, what do I care about the main character? No, you have to do both. I write dramas, what do I care about twists and turning points? No, you have to do both. So this idea, I think, of like being whole and not, or like, I don't want to market because I'm just a genius. I got to admit, I don't teach anything about marketing and business. It's not my strength. I don't like it. So like as a teacher, I'm allowed to do that. As a writer, guess what? I have to write the log line, which I hate. I'm not good at. I have to query people. I have to do everything. So it's like, you got to do both things. You have to make yourself whole. Like, you have to have your character arc as a writer and as a person.
Right.
Business and craft, character and story and you know, fun, internal, external, you got to be whole. You got to like kind of, because for you to put your best self out there, you have to access your whole self.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh my God. Well, okay.
Just the ones that come to your mind right now.
Okay. I got to give you two quick answers. The cliched version is everybody loves these and I feel like I'm boring. Godfather, Chinatown, Annie Hall, like sure. Everybody.
Yeah. Okay.
Bicycle Thieves is probably like my favorite of the classical. I'm Italian. It just hits me. Movies that like I thought I appreciated that were really personal that I found something surprising in. Breaking Away, Midnight Cowboy, Dead Ringers, Night of the Hunter. And movies I say like, you know what? There's my voice. I wish I could have written that. Alexander Payne, Election, Sideways kind of comes to mind.
Sure.
Breaking Away, Midnight Cowboy are so jam-packed with theme and coherency. They're just
– Well, that was like – That's like 10 movies. You did a good job.
I'm sorry. But it's all – you can't be pinned down. It's like
– No, I got you.
I tell you what though. If you think I'm going too far, like you could watch the first like 3 minutes of Midnight Cowboy and you could pick out 30 – I'm not kidding – 30 things that point to theme the way we talked about Seven and the way you think I went too far or what you imagine that someone would say I went too far. You could look at the first 3, 4, 5 minutes of Midnight Cowboy and you could easily pick out 30 clearly defined craft you know, techniques and attempts to make meaning and to set things up. I mean, it's so jam-packed. It's perfect.
And where can people find you?
My website, jamespmercurio.com. You can sign up for our newsletter there, which is free. Mm-hmm. There's some back issues. My DVD set there is there at a really super reduced price now. Mm-hmm. And if you want to, you know, talk to me about the coaching or script consulting, you can email me. We can have a talk, no pressure. I mean, my sales pitch usually is, you listen to me. If you like what I said, you think I can help you, you'll know. Right. So, like, there's the pitch. So, like, if you want to talk about it or if you want to check it out, yeah, go to jamespmercurio.com.
Jim, man, thank you so much. This has been an epic conversation, to say the least.
Thanks, buddy. And also, like I said, man, this whole appreciation for screenwriting, like, you appreciate it. And, like, I think you get excited because sometimes you learn stuff too. But, like, it's so vast. Have to be, and all the things you have to know, and I appreciate you fighting the good fight to get that out there.
You know, I appreciate it, man. Look, and I've listened or I've spoken to many of the people you've talked to, almost all of them that you quoted in this interview, and it's true. Like, I've learned so much over the course of the last 3 years of doing this because you learn from these different. You're just learning. I always look at it as this way: we're all looking at different pieces of the elephant in the room. No one's got it all figured out. But if you start piecing all of them together, you get a much more holistic approach to storytelling. And I think it's beneficial to everybody to learn from as many different sources as humanly possible. So thank you for dropping some major knowledge bombs today on The Tribe. I want to thank Jim for coming on the show and dropping some major knowledge bombs on The Tribe today. If you want to get links to his course, his workshops on IFH TV, or if you want to get in touch with him for some consulting, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/BPS033 for the show notes. And guys, if you have not already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really, really helps us out a lot on iTunes. Thanks again for listening, guys. And as always, keep on writing, no matter what.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.